This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for joining the show. Always glad to have you. Today, we're going to be talking about a pressing issue. It's not the first time we've talked about the issue, but it's definitely an issue that has been in the news cycle as of recent. And a lot of people have been exposed to a group that they probably hadn't heard about, but it's been a group that's been doing some things in Nigeria for quite some time. Boko Haram. A lot of people heard about them because they kidnapped over 200-something girls from their school. And now they have them holding them ransom, saying that they want to have certain people released in order to release these girls. So it's a big situation that a lot of people are troubled about. A lot of people, saying, what is State Department doing? What are our special forces? The president has sent certain resources into the country to possibly help. And people are wondering what's going on with that situation right now. We've got our guest today is Mark Schroeder. He's the vice president of Africa Analysis, and he is at Stratfor. Stratfor is a global intelligence firm that does a lot of different things, whether it be for government, nonprofit, or private sector, but they monitor a lot of different situations and usually have a good handle on what's going on in a number of different areas. Mark, welcome to Fed Access.
Great, Derek. Thanks. Thanks again for having me on your program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Mark, we've talked before in terms of, you know, the whole dynamic of Africa and everything else. This Boko Haram situation, you know, in terms of who they are and what they want and as it relates to Nigeria, what is it?
So, you know, Boko Haram is an Islamist militant group that has been active for, you know, let's say roughly 10 years. They've really escalated their insurgency over the last several years. You know, they came to the world's attention with the kidnapping of the schoolgirls 1 month ago. But they have been active in Nigeria for some time, and they feed into this strain of religious extremism, but also kind of political motivation to acquire and defend power.
You know, with all of that, I mean, you've got Nigeria kind of divided up into two different dynamics. I mean, the Christian side, the Muslim side, north and south. You know, a lot of people are wondering, is this group trying to take over the government? Or, I mean, do they just want, you know, Nigeria to be, you know, under a Sharia law? I mean, you know, what's the long-term goal of this organization?
Sure. This group, they're not really fighting to take over the government. They claim to be fighting to protect their religious interests and their name. You could translate it as Western education is a sin. But I would say that they are fighting to kind of strengthen Sharia law in northern Nigeria as a whole. But it's really not. You know, it's not an insurgency against the whole of the Nigerian government. It's not a grab to kind of take over the nation's territory and become the next government.
Hmm. And when we look at kind of the United States and people kind of saying, you know, why should we get involved in this? You know, what is the interest? I mean, a lot of people look at Nigeria in terms of oil resources. We know China has pushed into Nigeria a lot in terms of, you know, trying to utilize their oil resources. But, you know, a lot of people sometimes wonder, well, why should America be concerned about this? And why is that, Mark?
Yeah, and that's really a great question. The United States has been very mindful of Nigeria as a whole, you know, for the last several years. And, you know, the case of Boko Haram, you know, when it originally came up, you know, roughly 10 years ago, it was at the time named the Nigerian Taliban. And, you know, in the context of 9/11 and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, you could well understand that, you know, that the U.S. was very concerned about, you know, the possibility of a new Taliban, you know, emerging in West Africa. But, you know, the group was fairly quiet at that time. And, you know, coming back to, you know, why the U.S. is interested in it, I think, you know, the interests are really just to, you know, keep an eye on, you know, kind of extremist militancy in, you know, a relatively significant country in Africa. Nigeria is the largest oil and gas producer. United States does, you know, depend on Nigeria for, you know, a reasonable amount of kind of crude oil imports into the U.S. And, you know, just kind of given Nigeria's footprint, its population, it is the largest population in Africa. You know, it has a history of violence and militancy up and down the country. You know, anytime that there is kind of the threat of, you know, significant insecurity, you know, United States just wants to kind of keep a handle on things and make sure it doesn't get, you know, further out of control.
You know, as we begin to look at this and look at Boko Haram, you know, people say, well, Al-Qaeda affiliates is, and, you know, sometimes people toss Al-Qaeda on everything. You know, if it's a terrorist organization, they automatically say AQ. Is Boko Haram tied in with Al-Qaeda? Is this a threat that will go beyond Nigeria? You know, there's a number of Nigerians in America and in Europe and other places. Is this a threat that people are concerned about that will spread like we were concerned about Al-Shabaab?
Well, you know, I would say that, you know, Boko Haram is not, you know, kind of another franchise of Al-Qaeda. What we can say is there have been interactions between Boko Haram members and the Al-Qaeda franchise in Mali, Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, that is.
Hmm.
And some interactions with Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And when I say interactions, I mean members of Boko Haram, you know, going across the border to conduct themselves with the, you know, kind of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb leaders and fighters and the Al-Shabaab leaders and fighters in Somalia, and to kind of learn and you know, try to, you know, kind of improve their kind of their capabilities. That is the kind of interaction that we have seen, as opposed to Boko Haram kind of morphing into Al-Qaeda and kind of expanding, you know, kind of Al-Qaeda's reach, you know, into Nigeria. That, you know, that we haven't seen. And given kind of the broader counterterrorism efforts in the Sahel region of West Africa, led by France, supported by the United States, you know, it would be very difficult for Boko Haram to actually, you know, escalate and become, you know, a franchise of Al-Qaeda, you know, given the significant, you know, defeat of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb.
Right, right, right. So we're looking at a more kind of regional scenario. Are we concerned that American interests, I mean, I know Boko Haram have been definitely utilizing bombing tactics, kidnapping tactics. Are we concerned that Western interests, whether it be oil companies or U.S. business interests that may be operating in Nigeria, is there a concern that they may be under attack, or has Boko Haram kind of stayed away and really put their attacks more towards Nigerians themselves?
So Boko Haram has clearly focused their attacks on Nigerian targets, and that includes civilians and the schoolgirls, you know, that has caught the world's attention. But, you know, against government officials and against security force, you know, personnel, military and police. And the area of operations that Boko Haram has concentrated its attacks in is northeastern Nigeria, and that is a part of the country largely absent, you know, any kind of Western facilities, installations, infrastructure, or even meaningful economic activity. Nigeria, as we mentioned, is known for its oil and gas, and pretty much all of that oil and gas is located in the far south, where Boko Haram has no presence in.
Okay.
So when we ask that question, you know, is there a threat to American interests or kind of Western interests or economic activity? You know, we really haven't seen that yet. It's more of a kind of a general concern for, you know, Boko Haram operating in the northern part of the country.
Do we feel like that, based on kind of analysis and looking at where they're going, do we feel like it's going to stay, you know, kind of quarantined into that area and not go to Abuja or not go to like other parts that you mentioned in the south, that the oil rich, you know, parts of the country? Is it going to stay within that north area?
So that really is the critical question, and at Stratfor, how we view it is, a lot will depend on what happens at the elections in Nigeria that will take place next February. And there are deep divisions within kind of the political structures of Nigeria, and there is an impact on how the counterinsurgency is fought by those political divisions. And if the current government is to be reelected, you know, we would likely see a further escalation of the Boko Haram and militant violence against the Nigerian government, and could even see that spread outside of the northeastern region of the country that Boko Haram has limited their attacks to. We could see that spread into Abuja and perhaps other southern parts of the country as part of a political blowback against the Goodluck Jonathan administration.
You bring me into the next topic I want to talk about after we get off the break. Got to take a quick break, but I want to talk about the impact of elections and the impact of the country. And then, you know, with Nigeria being one of the top countries along with South Africa, what is the impact on the whole continent as we begin looking at the kind of the future of where things are going? We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He is the vice president of Africa Analysis at Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com. They have a great amount of analysis on their website that you can find on a number of different countries. But we're talking about Africa today. We're talking about Boko Haram. We're talking about what's going on in Nigeria with the kidnapping of these girls and how they can possibly get returned to their families. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're having an interesting conversation about what's going on in Africa, specifically Nigeria, specifically Boko Haram, a group that has taken the headlines of some of the news cycle in terms of now they've kidnapped these over 200 young girls, these schoolgirls they've kidnapped, and they have them held and using them for ransom and saying that they may sell them off and do certain things. And a lot of people are wondering, how can these young girls be returned back to their families? America has gotten involved. We're all wondering what is going to be the next cycle. You know, will there be a counterterrorism mission to get them back? Will there be diplomacy? Will there be a ransom paid to get them back? What will happen in terms of Boko Haram? But beyond this, who is Boko Haram, and what's the impact of the whole country in terms of where the country is going with elections and everything else? We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He is vice president of Africa Analysis at Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com, but they're a global intelligence firm that focuses in on basically forecasting, intelligence gathering, understanding the issues around the world, and providing that analysis to government agencies, to private sector companies, and to nonprofit and NGOs. Mark, we were talking about the impact of elections in terms of, you know, you mentioned about the Goodluck Jonathan administration, and you know, there's definitely a schism there between the North and the South, and the Christians and the Muslims. Is there a speculation that Boko Haram is kind of working to kind of derail the elections, that this kidnapping of the girls will now kind of, you know, provide a maybe a no confidence in the administration, the current administration, that will impact the elections coming up?
Certainly, you know, Boko Haram operations call into question the capability of the Goodluck Jonathan administration at providing security in the country. And I would say that, you know, Boko Haram is really designed to undermine the Jonathan administration and to in other words, kind of hold the country hostage to say, you know, we need to return, you know, north our power to northerner interests who can take care of the Boko Haram threat and take power away from Goodluck Jonathan, who, to his opponents, is seen as in over his head in managing the country's, you know, many crises.
You know, with all of that, are some people concerned that, you know, political parties, and I'm just asking this question, Mark, because I've just kind of heard conversations about it, that maybe political parties who are against the current administration, that they may be funding or supporting Boko Haram or in some kind of way. Is that something that you've heard, or that there may be speculation about?
Yeah, those concerns are very valid. And if I can just, you know, kind of take a step back to say that the political sponsorship of gangs and militant groups in Nigeria is a common practice. And President Jonathan himself came to power first as vice president in 2007 on the back of a very, you know, violent militant campaign in the Niger Delta region, led by groups like the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, when they went around and destroyed oil pipelines and platforms and kidnapped foreign oil workers. And Jonathan was part and parcel of a campaign that used those militant groups to demand political power in exchange for, you know, sharing that economic resource that they had. Now, turning to Boko Haram and aggrieved politicians in northern Nigeria, certainly there would be, you know, those linkages with, you know, kind of sympathetic northerner politicians turning at the very least a blind eye, if not providing support in one form or another to Boko Haram, to really put the Jonathan administration on the back foot and ultimately to be able to return political power to the north of Nigeria.
If that shifts, if the election shifts and Goodluck Jonathan does lose and loses to the north and other factions, will that change the scope of Nigeria in terms of their interaction with the world? I know Nigeria has tried to interact with the world on a different level and say, hey, listen, come and invest in the country, come and take a look at the country, we have these resources. Will that begin to change?
Well, I think the Nigerian government, you know, if it were to change, you know, at the next election, would still see, you know, their place as they're an important, you know, country in the international system, especially for its oil and gas resources.
Mm-hmm.
And that would remain, you know, kind of in place. What I would expect is, you know, if it would probably be a more effective counterinsurgency program and more effective because a northerner Nigerian leadership would have a better chance of winning the support of the local politicians, the local tribal and religious leadership, the local community leadership, and really, you know, kind of conducting the hearts and minds campaign of combating the Boko Haram insurgency. And that's the sort of behavior that the Jonathan administration just it cannot be successful at.
You know, when people, we've heard that American resources have been put on the ground, you know, to assist, you know, and maybe other countries, British and everything else. When we look at that, what does that entail, Mark? I mean, what in terms of looking, and then people will also say, well, why can't we find, you know, they see the video of these girls out there and all gathered, and people are wondering, why can't we find, you know, all these young ladies who are out there, find their camp? I mean, what, in terms of either the landscape of the country, is it difficult to find somebody because of the massive nature of the country, or what would that be?
Sure, and that's exactly part of it. We're talking about a vast territory in northern Nigeria. We're talking about you know, hundreds of small villages where the schoolgirls, you know, could be dispersed among, you know, in small cells, and trying to track down, you know, what could be, you know, small cells of say half a dozen or a dozen mm-hmm. girls at a time, you know, in hundreds of villages across hundreds of miles is, you know, an extremely complicated, you know, and time-consuming task. And we're not even talking about the possibility that some of these cells of girls have been taken across the very porous borders into countries like Cameroon and Chad and Niger, you know, maybe even Mali. And so, you know, you look at kind of the vast territory, you look at the kind of the complicated topography, you know, and the hundreds of villages that the girls could be, you know, hidden in, you know, just makes the task of surveillance and analysis and recovery just very complicated. To your other question on what has been the response by the U.S. government has been, you know, to provide, you know, in intelligence collection means, technical, aviation, and really to provide that to the Nigerian authorities and provide, you know, analysis capabilities to the Nigerian authorities so that the Nigerians, you know, can take the lead on recovering the girls once the location of the girls is determined. But at this point, you know, it's not even, you know, no one has a clear idea where the girls are.
And what I'm hearing from you is not, given the nature of this in terms of, it seems as if Boko Haram probably would have a wide range of support in these villages. I mean, that people would support what they're doing. So they would, you know, help them. They would do a lot of support for them, break the girls up and maybe hide them. And security forces just can't walk into these places. It seems like there's no really security presence in these places. They can just go in and walk in and just start, you know, going through and from house to house. That's not necessarily realistic, is it?
That's right. That's right. And even for the Nigerian military, you know, they don't necessarily have a presence in all of these cities. And the last thing you'd want is to have, you know, kind of foreign military forces walking through a number of villages up there, you know, if you don't even have Nigerian forces in the first place. And that would just, you know, kind of escalate tensions and issues, you know, even more. That, and certainly that's not what we're seeing and not what we're expecting to see, you know, from the U.S. and from other Western governments that are providing assistance. I think, you know, that Western assistance and American assistance will still be limited, you know, to intelligence sharing and collection, you know, methods and to relay these to the Nigerians who will still be, you know, the primary forces on the ground.
Last question, Mark, and then I know we got to take a break. And then we're going to be talking to your colleague, Fred, about Mexico and cartels and everything else. But in terms of the outcome, of course, the best outcome. But what are we predicting maybe in the near future? Is this something that seems to not really have a short term outcome that we'll get these girls back? Because it seemed like the ransom of releasing people is not realistic. What are we looking at as a possible outcome coming up?
You know, I wonder about the ransom option, though. I wonder if it could actually be a realistic option. Even though, you know, of course, there are all sorts of concerns raised when you do pay ransoms to recover a hostage. But you know, to send in, you know, security forces to try to, you know, conduct a hostage rescue operation, you know, the chances of that being conducted successfully, you know, given that the girls are probably, you know, spread out among, you know, multiple villages and small locations, you know, the ability to recover all of those girls safely, you know, is going to be very, very difficult. And so that brings us back to, you know, what are other options, and other options basically being, you know, how can we, you know, negotiate to recover these girls, you know, perhaps pay a ransom. And I'm not suggesting that the U.S. would do that, but, you know, this is still primarily a Nigerian issue and concern, you know, that the Nigerian government conduct, you know, some kind of negotiation like this and get the, you know, get the immediate issue of the girls off the table, you know, dealing with the more longer term issue of how do you resolve the Boko Haram insurgency. You know, that's going to require, you know, additional and long term efforts.
Thank you so much, Mark, for your analysis on this. And we're going to definitely stay on top of this. So I'll definitely be talking to you again as this story evolves and as Africa becomes more and more important part of our conversation in the United States. We'll definitely be keeping on top of this. When we come back, we'll be talking to Fred Burton. He is an expert on Mexico. He's one of the vice president of intelligence at Stratfor. He's an expert on Mexico. We'll be talking about what's going on there with the cartels. And we'll also be talking about Benghazi. He wrote a book about Benghazi, and you know, it's been in the press again. So we're going to get some updates on and his thoughts on the Benghazi situation. Has anything changed? Has anything improved since that time in terms of State Department security and keeping our ambassadors safe? You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. If you have been listening to the show, we have been talking about Nigeria and talking about Boko Haram and talking about what's going on with the kidnapping of these girls. But now we're going to switch and switch gears and get into a couple other issues and talk about first Benghazi and then talk about what's going on in Mexico. If you've been listening to Fed Access for quite some time, that's one of the issues that I've always thought was important, what's going on in our borders. And we've had an expert, Fred Burton, the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. He's always he's an expert on this, and he's always kept us up to date on what's going on with the cartels and what's going on in that area, in that region. Fred, welcome to Fed Access.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
Hey, thanks for coming on back. Fred, you know, you wrote a book about Benghazi. It's popped back up in the news. Give us updates on what's been happening in terms of Benghazi. And even, you know, has there been any improvements in terms of State Department as it relates to the protection of ambassadors, protection of State Department facilities and personnel on the ground? Or has it just kind of been the talk for a quick second and nothing's really changed?
Well, unfortunately, Benghazi's security posture continues to deteriorate. There were three political assassinations today in Benghazi. You had the Jordanian ambassador to Libya that was actually kidnapped and held hostage in Tripoli. And unfortunately, the Jordanians exchanged a terrorist in their custody for the Jordanian ambassador. There are also Tunisian diplomats that have been kidnapped inside of Tripoli. And this is the backdrop for the redeployment of some of the U.S. Marine Corps assets to Italy so they can be in a position to respond to North Africa and primarily Libya, which is one of the post-Benghazi takeaways. But since the unfortunate death of the United States ambassador in Benghazi and Information Officer Smith and the two former U.S. Navy SEALs for the CIA, DS, the Diplomatic Security Service, has made several proactive moves in not only ramping up high-threat training for their agents and security protection specialists that are around the globe, but they've also worked in close partnership with the U.S. Marines to bolster up the Marine Security Guard program to prevent future Benghazis from happening. But in many ways, Derek, as we all know, the State Department has a long history of disaster, and diplomats will continue to be targeted anytime you have that symbolic fixed location like we have our footprint in some of these troubled paths. You're always going to have terrorist surveillance and targeting of U.S. diplomatic missions.
You know, with the Libya situation, and Fred, talk to us about that real quick, because everybody thought that, you know, after, you know, the change of the Gaddafi administration and regime and that dictatorship, that, you know, maybe the country has some hope. I mean, it seems that the country is on a spiral downwards. And are we concerned that this is going to be another hotbed like a Yemen or other areas where it becomes a wild, wild west situation, a hotbed of terrorism and everything else? Is that becoming more and more of a concern?
Derek, there has been little to no security improvements in country. Tripoli is a little bit better, but having said that, whenever you have a foreign ambassador, like in this case the Jordanian ambassador, kidnapped and held hostage, it just goes to show you the challenges that the host government has. In many ways, Libya is lawless. There is no public safety. There is no public security apparatus that is capable of dealing with not only your rogue militias, but your terrorist groups such as Ansar al-Sharia and al-Qaeda and all the different variants that are in play there. So this is one of the places that we need to be from an intelligence perspective in order to keep a pulse on terrorists. and trending and movements and so forth. But let's face it, it's a dangerous world. And at the end of the day, the Foreign Service needs to be in dangerous places at times in order to carry out the foreign policy of our country.
You know, when Fred, you when you did your book and kind of was looking at that, and please definitely get the title of the book because I want people to know about it. But when you did your book, were you uncovering that you know, because, you know, we've had this conversation about, hey, cover-ups and this, that, and the other. Did you kind of, was there kind of a dynamic of a cover-up or anything that you saw that people were not addressing or trying to hide? Or was it just really that people did not have their eye on the ball? They weren't taking the security situation as serious that they should have. And maybe it wasn't, you know, just, you know, pure negligence, but maybe bureaucracy caused negligence in a number of different ways. What did you determine?
Well, my book is called Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi, and thank you for that, Derek. In essence, it's a complicated answer. You have an organization like the Diplomatic Security Service that basically supports the Foreign Service mission, and they don't have a seat at the table with the Secretary of State. Diplomatic security is buried inside the telephone directories and the flow chart of the State Department. They have an assistant secretary, but they don't have an undersecretary that reports directly to the secretary. So, in essence, they go where the Foreign Service sends them. And if you go back to Benghazi on the terrorist attack which killed Ambassador Stevens, in reality, Benghazi was one of many posts around the world that I'm sad to say was just as bad. So if you have a fixed number of assets, it becomes a shell game. And at the end of the day, what happens is, and you and I know this from your background, junior agents, although they are very good people and highly trained and highly motivated, are typically sent to most of the more dangerous places around the globe. And that's just the way it is. It's always been that way. It was like that when I was an agent. That's how you earn your stripes, so to speak. And 9 times out of 10, nothing ever happens. But when things go bad in this business, they go bad very, very quickly.
You know, with that, Fred, I mean, are we seeing, and I know you used to have that time in diplomatic security and you were running counterterrorism operations there and probably still talk to a lot of people in DS. Is this changing a culture? I mean, I know that the culture in State Department, they're still buried down. And I know there was a little bit movement about kind of maybe trying to change maybe the where they were on the flow chart. But in terms of the culture of the agents, is that changing? Are we seeing an increase of hiring? Or is the training changing? Are you seeing any other things that would kind of improve these security situations on the ground?
Well, I do know that morale is pretty bad if you talk to your average agents. There's only so many times you can send personnel to the Kabuls and the Baghdads and the Tripolis of the world before you really want to get back home,
right,
and serve in a decent kind of post. Having said that, the State Department has made a tremendous effort, specifically diplomatic security, to incorporate better training. For example, on a practical level, how do you protect a dignitary when fire is used as a weapon?
Hmm.
When I was an agent, we were not trained to protect when someone sets a building on fire. That's the kind of challenge that is daunting at times. You know, agents aren't trained to be firefighters and so and cross-trained in that kind of capacity, but maybe they should be to some degree.
Right.
And as you get into the third world, you know, there are no building standards, there are no sprinkler systems, there's no fire department at times. So these are the kinds of challenges that are going to be prevalent in the foreseeable future, especially when you look at the simplicity of fire being used as a weapon.
You know, for I think you made a just good point, because I think I even saw in a recent recruitment piece that they had fire fire training as one of the pieces that I think now DS people go through, the DS agents go through. And I think that's probably one of these changes from a Benghazi situation that you just mentioned, that the dynamics of protection and security is evolving, that you now need to know so many different things. It's not just intellectual property security, you know, information security, or just, you know, weapons and you know, kind of the gates, but there are so many different facets to it, the bombs and everything else.
That's right. It's no longer just guns, guards, and gates. You know, you're cross-trained to do not only criminal investigations for passport and visa fraud and counterterrorism and protective intelligence investigations, such as threats against the Secretary of State or diplomatic missions, but you also have to be able to get out and perform a protection job in an arena that has traditionally been performed by, let's say, members of the military special operations community, former JSOC operators, former SEALs. So it gets into how the selection of personnel comes into play, what kind of people are you hiring, and how are you trained. For
right.
example, you're trained not to play Rambo at times. You're trained to cover and evacuate a protectee, take that protectee to a safe haven, which is exactly what the agents did in Benghazi. Then the buildings lit on fire. So this becomes a training challenge. It becomes a personnel selection challenge. But I will say this. I've had a lot of conversations with DS agents, and I'm continually impressed with the quality of and the background of the agents that they're hiring. In many ways, they are hiring the best and the brightest.
You know, when we come back, I want to, you know, go to Mexico, but I think you made an important point about just how dangerous this job is, and the criteria in terms of selecting the right people for the right jobs, because they're oftentimes, you know, alone or have a very, very small group of people that they have to rely on against sometimes overwhelming odds in a certain country. And so that kind of stuff is so important. And you know, diplomatic security is definitely one of our top, you know, agencies in terms of law enforcement. They have a unique mission unlike any others. And so I think you made a very, very important point about what needs to be done in the future. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. He's an expert on a number of different areas. But today we're talking about Benghazi. He wrote a book on Benghazi called Under Fire. But we're going to also swing over and talk about what's going on in Mexico with some of the cartels. Fred keeps abreast of it. Stratfor is located in Texas, and they always are on top of what's happening with some of these cartels, and we're going to get an update when we come back. We're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about what's going on around the world. We've hit everything from Nigeria, we've hit Libya, and now we're going to start talking about what's going on with the cartels, what's going on in Mexico. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. Stratfor.com is where you can find them. They are a global intelligence firm that, you know, focuses on all different countries. They do analysis, forecasting. They do a number of different kind of, you know, threat assessments and everything else about what's happening with anything in the world. Fred, you keep abreast on Mexico. What's going on with the cartels? I mean, there's a lot of things that's been happening, assassinations and all this other kind of stuff. Give us an update.
Well, the more recent event that we find extraordinarily interesting was that on May 9th last week, Z9, Melado Cruz, one of the earliest members of the La Zeta organization, which is historically one of the most violent Mexican cartels, Z9 was killed in a firefight with Mexican troops in Reynosa. And although he was one of the original founding members of the Zeta organization, he was also a member of the Gulf Cartel, which shows the fracturing and the realignments that take place within these organizations at times. And the curious things as we watch this unfold, and we're here in Austin, Texas, so we're a little closer to the problem than most people, especially inside the Beltway, but There was reports of running gun battles and helicopter gunships and firefights in Reynosa. So we knew that we had Mexican federal police and Mexican military activity chasing a high-value target, and lo and behold, it was Z9. But this is the kind of event that, as we talk to our clients and our multinational corporations and our executives and folks with huge manufacturing operations in Mexico, is that you always have to be cognizant of, in that these kinds of events can break out literally at any place and at any time. Now, in fairness to the Mexican government, they have had some significant kill captures of most predominantly the Sinaloa Federation, most notably El Chapo, who actually was on the Forbes list. They've been successful in capturing him. They've been successful in capturing one of his high-level deputies. So they are making strides. But at the end of the day, even though they've killed and captured all these high-value targets, it really hasn't reduced the flow of drugs north. That's the rub, meaning is the strategy working? You can go after the top-tier targets, but there is no slow role of drugs flowing north and bulk cash flowing south and stolen weapons and stolen cars flowing south. So it's just another day in Mexico.
You know, you talk about the it hasn't decreased in terms of, is that because the demand is still there? I mean, you know, we talk about kind of the legalization of drugs. We talk about a number of different things, but it does not seem to have curtailed the demand for this. And as long as this demand is here, it seems like these cartels will always have this business model. But even with that, they have also strayed off and said, well, listen, we'll do home invasions. We'll do human trafficking. If we do see a small demand in something, we'll move over into something else. Is that the case, Fred?
That is the case. They're running crystal meth into the United States, black tar heroin, bulk marijuana. And one of the more troubling developments, which is near and dear to my heart, and I know you will find this of interest, is, again, there's been a recent spate of police corruption cases on the U.S. side of the border. In fact, a smaller police department in one of the border towns, their entire narcotics unit has recently been indicted for corruption, public integrity. And so as you look at that, you know, the FBI is making strides at trying to break the back of some of these systemic kind of problems. But, you know, the scope of these kinds of issues are really daunting. And in my discussions, for example, with various DEA and FBI officials, you know, the scope of the public integrity cases, predominantly in South Texas and as you move anywhere across the border, are overwhelming.
Wow. You know, Fred, you kind of, you know, really kind of segue right into where I wanted to go in terms of the resources in terms of the federal government being put into now. And it seems as if whether it be DEA or FBI, whether it be the corruption or whether it be dealing with this thing head, face to face. Are you seeing the resources still being put into this, or is it just kind of like, hey, this is just the nature of the beast and we'll deal with it as we can? Are we seeing more resources, especially as we've gone out of Afghanistan and other areas? Are we seeing a redirection, even the military, National Guard, or other resources to deal with these issues?
Not really. I'm sad to say it's still a resource challenge problem, but it's also a public integrity issue. It's a matter of focus. Let me give you a practical kind of problem. DEA will tell you that they're one step behind of the drug runners because most of the drug runners are using throwaway phones, you know, these track phones that you can pick up, and then they use them one time, and then they throw them away. So all of your wonderful SIGINT, ELINT capabilities, your intercept capabilities, are usually behind the curve in trying to make sense of the actual tactical drug runs. So you have a lot of just basic good police work, cops and state troopers stopping drug runs, and they're all over the map. You have from tractor trailer to old people driving cars with dope in them to moms with babies driving cars. So there really isn't a profile. It kind of ebbs and flows at times as to specific profiles, but you know, the bulk of the dope is running up through our wonderful interstate transportation systems, predominantly the I-35 corridor, which runs up from Mexico into Texas, where it branches off to I-20, I-10, I-40, and goes east and west, and then ends up in Washington, D.C., Chicago, L.A., and so forth.
Wow. It's daunting, Fred, and we could talk about this all day. The updates that you give, you know, it lets us realize that we've got to stay on top of this, and more resources have to be dedicated to this, because, you know, this drug game and the consequences of it, whether it be human trafficking and these cartels, are critical, you know, to our homeland security, our national security, and everything else, and weakens our nation if we don't do anything about it. Fred Burton, he's Vice President of Intelligence. Thank you, Fred, for covering all of this.
My pleasure, Derek. Thank you for having me.
Fred Burton, he's Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com. You can find his book at Under Fire. You can find it anywhere, Fred, Amazon, everywhere else?
Yes, sir. You can pick it up at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or electronic download.
You can check his book out about Benghazi, and we have to stay abreast of these issues. We're going to keep on talking about it. Fred, we'll definitely check back in with you in the near future. You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com.